gives you a pleasure to introduce Jérôme, who I've known for quite a while now, a few decades, I think, over in Lille. Yes. And Jérôme is most famous for his work on the biomass allometry of tropical forests and compiling the data on allometry that provides the equations that almost everybody uses when they're trying to estimate the biomass and carbon stores of the tropics. I'm not sure that paper must, what the citation numbers on that paper are, but they're probably many thousands, I imagine. but beyond that, he's actually a much broader ecophysicist in some way, looking at the physics and structure of tropical forest communities and applying his physical insight into understanding the mathematics and structure of tropical forests. So, yeah. And not surprisingly, he holds a PhD in physics from Orsay University. And after that, he did a postdoc in Princeton with Steve McCullough for a couple of years, and then moved on to Toulouse, where he's been in different forms ever since. And he's currently coordinator of the LabX Center for the Study of Biodiversity in Amazonia, which focuses is both a French and a French Guiana based institution. And he's scientific director of the famous NIRAG Ecological Research Station in French Guiana. So, well, welcome, Jérôme.
Well, thank you very much, Edvinder. Thank you all for being here. Can you hear me in the back? Try to make sure this is the this is what I should be using.
Right. Or you can just the keyboard if you want. Okay. There's a point. There's a point there if you want.
Okay.
There's a, yeah.
Okay. So Yadvinder and I have been working together for quite some time actually. But it's my first time in Oxford, and so I'm really pleased to be here. I learned that all what I heard about the weather is actually not true, and I'll let people know that, you know, it's always sunny and really pleasant in the UK, and it's Oxford especially. So my talk today is about the aspects of allometry, plant allometry, but also trying to think about this issue of the type of data we have at the moment, the types of models we have, and how we can fuse data and models to make sense of the crucial questions we have about tropical forests and actually temperate forests as well. My talk is co-authored by Isabelle Maréchal and Fabian Fischer, who've been both in my lab a while back. Isabelle is now in a permanent position in Montpellier, and Fabian is winding up his PhD now. So the overall question I'd like to discuss here, the overall overarching goal of my talk is to ask big questions like the carbon cycle. You've all seen this slide trying to attribute the different carbon cycle elements to causes of source and then sinks. And you see that tropical and mostly tropical deforestation and degradation contributes for a large part here to the emissions of carbon dioxide. And also that forest and terrestrial biosphere contribute to a large proportion to the uptake of that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So those are two key elements in which the terrestrial ecosystems are playing a large role. And of course, here we know much better the contributions of the atmosphere because the carbon dioxide has been measured for a long time, and we think that we know bit better the oceanic component. So the big unknown is here, and to a large extent also here. The amount of tropical deforestation has been documented here in the Global Carbon Project based on modeling, accounting approaches of modeling, the bookkeeping model that Houghton has been developed for a long time, and it's missing a lot of elements, and it's based on data from the FAO. Those data are far from perfect, and so you know there is always lingering doubts about the contribution of deforestation and degradation in this cycle. Well, this is the overall picture, and of course the forests are important. Being French, I couldn't miss giving you this slide. The Paris Agreement is mostly about trying to find policies to curb the increase of carbon dioxide and global change, but it has a lot to do with forests. and has to do with it being inclusive of the forest component in this element, trying to have a financial element to this aspect, and try to also have a political contribution to this, trying to make sure that countries comply. But the overall goal of this talk is not to talk about the financial and political aspects. It's rather to try to be sure that what we're talking about with the contribution of forests to global change is something that we can actually measure and contribute. And there are elements of colleagues who are working on very interesting aspects of how do we come about with trying to engineer the forest to uptake more carbon with natural forest regeneration or work on secondary forests. There's been a lot of fantastic research on this, and this recent paper in Nature is kind of interesting review. I'm sure you've seen this already. But what we really know from at a global scale is what's coming from the FAO, the Forest Resource Assessment. It's been actually going on for a very long time. It's one of the first venture, one of the first commitments of the FAO when it was constructed created in 1948, was to construct a global forest resource assessment, mostly for production purposes at the beginning, and then through time. So I'm putting this slide, which is perhaps not very clear. What this slide is about here is coming from Martin Herold's group. They've been looking at the quality of data across the national forest assessments in different countries, trying to grade them from very good to inexistent or not even included, so low to high. Unfortunately, the gray colors are not don't deliver so well. And looking through time, in 2005, 2010, 2015, and you see that through time there is a bit of improvement, but mostly in the tropics especially, the quality of these assessments have been quantified as being intermediate at best. That means that what the data reported by the countries to the FAO as part of this reports every 5 years are of intermediate quality, and especially when it comes to carbon pools. Of course, the Forest Resource Assessment is not only about reporting carbon, it's much more general. It has all the resources. This is a small logo here. There's a lot of services and so forth. But this is an important point. Okay, so today what I'd like to discuss with you, if you like, is what's the future of reporting methods for carbon pool? Can forest dynamic models assimilate the new types of data, and how? So, of course, I'm hugely biased here towards one model, and I'm unapologetic about this. I'll be talking about that model to sort of see the pros and cons of individual-based models, to name it. And then how can models shed light on forest structure and tree allometry, which is very much my topic. So the types of technology that have been out there, and I'm teaching no one here what LiDAR is and what airborne LiDAR is, because especially in the Windows lab, you've been doing this for a very long time. But just as a recap, instrumental LiDAR is a laser rangefinder, which is covering a large ground and positioning very precisely clouds of point from above. And so one of the clear, very simple outcome of this type of approach is that you can detect at high spatial resolution that the points are a few millimeters to centimeter in footprint, the height of a tree and the height of the terrain. So basically forest height can be estimated very carefully. So what can we do with this? Well, quite obviously you can do a lot of things. One of the most wonderful applications of this is to do archaeology in the tropics. I'm sure you've seen this paper. It's so fantastic. It's a paper from Canito et al. In Science. So when you strip away the forest in this environment, so this is obviously an area that's been known for a while, but though if you go below the forest, you realize the sheer area of this of the constructions, and because the archaeological remains are fairly clearly identified in the digital elevation model, and so especially these large areas like the Champs-Élysées of the Mayas, and so it's actually quite amazing as an application, and it's been done in many places. To my knowledge, not so much over the Amazon, but one day
if we have a lot of money, if we can cover wall-to-wall the Amazon with these high-resolution LiDAR technologies, I'm sure we'll find much more in terms of archaeology in these areas. This is not the topic of my talk. The topic of my talk is to try to quantify above-ground biomass in tropical forests. And I'll take a random example, which is, you know, NORAG, obviously. This is, I couldn't help but advertise this. So this is a fuel station in French Guiana, which is part of Amazonia. Apologies for the Brazilians, not Amazonia Legal, it's not the Amazon Basin, but it's the Amazonian biome. Can we agree on that? All right. Good. I was stressed. So now that this part is over, I can go on. This place can be accessed by helicopter. This is the helipad here, and we can go up. And I invite you all to come. It's a really cool place. So what we've been doing is just an example. We've been covering this 2,000 hectares of area with LiDAR. This is the terrain. This is the canopy height. The canopy height model, and this is the vegetation classes that you can also infer from the area. And when you take this landscape scale approach of a tropical forest, you realize a number of things. You realize that the forest is far more heterogeneous than we previously thought. These areas are bamboo formations or liana formations here, and they are actually interspersed. Is that related to humans again or not? Is that related to the ground? We don't quite know, but it's really fertile ground for research. We have a total of 32 hectares of permanent plots here, with one 12-hectare plot, which we would like in the future, God helping us, turn into a CTFS site, so sample from 1 centimeter onwards. So actually, there are two stations. One is here, the insular station, and the other is here. And the bottom one here is near the river Aratai, and it has this canopy operating permit access system, this COPAS, which allows you to go individually to the canopy, above the canopy, and to sample and do whatever business you like to do with the canopy. So it's a really cool thing here. So yeah, I don't have a slide for this, but happy to do this. What we can do with this type of approach is to try to convert above ground forest height to carbon stocks, and that is, you know, a tricky business. We have to have sites to validate this type of relationships, and if it's, you know, if we trust this relationship, then we can convert the height metric into a biomass map, which again looks very much more heterogeneous than, you know, the reporting that we have in many of the maps, like the Sansa sheet map, which is much more homogeneous. And so this is an interesting result, but of course we can do this over 2,000 hectares, and the human nature is that such that we would like to do this over the entire world, which is now becoming possible, as you well know. It's been possible for a while because this project with ISAT has made it possible to collect a fair amount of shots, individual shots, over the Amazon. This is the actual number of shots that have been taken from the CIMAR et al. Paper. It's not so dense, but it was a great advance, and there's nothing better today, still. The next step is, of course, the JEDI mission, I'm sure. Does anyone not know about the JEDI mission? Okay, this is just exactly that. A satellite or airborne satellite-borne instrument that will take exactly the same type of information here, only 10,000 times more. So it will really cover a lot more ground than the ice, the glass instrument. It's not on board a satellite; it's on board the ISS, and it will be. It's been launched actually. It's been installed last year. It's been in commissioning phase. It will, and the data will be released sometime in September. So this data will be available. And this is the sampling intensity. You don't see this really well, but the area here covered. This is each point is a shot, LiDAR shot, and the size here is 4.2 kilometers. So you will have a point every 600 meters, wall to wall, and the mission will be commissioned for a year. So that's just crazy. This is the type of data we'll have very soon, in a few weeks' time, should I say. Okay, the other really cool instrument, called Rocket Science, this is the biomass satellite. It will be launched in 2022. And it's a real technological challenge, because this is the actual instrument that will be launched. Because this instrument is in P-band, and it's a sensitive aperture radar. In P-band, it's 70 centimeters. It has to have an antenna. It's really large. It's never been done before. It will be the first satellite of its kind. And you see the size of it. I don't have it in the top of my head. I think it's over 10 meters in the area. It has to be unfolded like a flower when it's launched. So a lot of technological challenges. It was planned for launching in 2021. 2022, and then perhaps it will be early 2023 now, because I mean it's difficult to manufacture that. What it will be doing will be to use a number of instruments and technologies based on SAR, sensitive aperture radar, a basic intensity, a dual intensity, which is called pulling SAR, or this type of really fun approach, which is basically slicing down the forest. It's tomography with SAR, with radar. And so it's taking different layers of the forest and trying to detect which is the most relevant zone within the forest canopy that correlates with biomass. This is a really, really promising approach, because unlike the LiDAR approach that I was mentioning previously, this approach really has a lot more information, and it's wall-to-wall. And because it's a radar, it doesn't care about clouds. So it will be really covering wall-to-wall the planet. These are the specs, just so you know. The resolution of the biomass products that we aim at producing in this with this project has a resolution of 4 hectares with uncertainty of 20%. It will also produce a canopy height model with a resolution of four hectares again. And again, uncertainty, this is the PollinSAR approach. And it will also produce a disturbance map. So of course, this is not the only instrument that can produce a disturbance map, but it will be good to sort of compare the types of produce, because optical imagery is notoriously bad at picking up the early disturbance, recovering forest. So how do we validate all these products? This is where I think a lot of work has been underestimated by the satellite engineering missions, that we need to have a full network of sites with high quality data that can be used to compare the quality of the output from the satellite to the actual values of biomass. What we've been proposing in this recent paper that would be to use, especially to focus on high biomass areas, and use a lot of sites that we know very well. Typically, the gem plots would be in there, but it would have to be plots that have A, long-term infrastructure, B, at least 10 hectares of area covered, and C, airborne LiDAR map, because as I explained before, I think it's a really plus, a good plus to understand the landscape scale structure of the forest. We've pre-selected something around 100 sites across the tropics. And now we're looking for, naively looking for funding for the next 10 years to make sure these sites are well funded, to make and making sure that during the lifetime of this biomass mission, there will be re-measurements on site.
Just to check that is White and Woods, the UK site there, isn't it?
This is White and Woods.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it the proper location?
Long story short, we try to include the data from forest plots, a subset of course, because not all the data comply with these conditions, and the data from CTFS forest geo, and all the sites in Europe, in North America, are the forest geo sites. We're trying to venture into Russia as well, with Dmitry Shapashenko, who is a co-PI of this project for the Forest Observation System. And that's hard, but we're getting there. Okay, now I'd like to shift gears and talk a bit about the modeling aspects. And you know, try to explain why it's important to combine the two. Of course, we have this massive amounts of data, but we won't be able to make predictions. We can wait until the end of the mission and detect trends. I think there is a lot to be done with this type of data, but it will be in 10 years' time, and there's a sense of urgency today, especially Climate Day, and all this and activity. So we need to be responsive and to the society, and to have modeling tools that can incorporate this type of data and create forecasts that are relevant. So for the moment, a large activity is around the land surface models, which are integrative approaches where the vegetation is part of a much larger, many more modules, including the water cycle, the atmospherics, the structure of the atmosphere and its physics, and the fluxes are being modeled in very carefully. So those models have been developed for a long time, and I'm sure you know them well, and Eliflux stories have been at the heart of the validation of these instruments. There is a different type of models, the individual-based models, that have been mostly developed for forestry applications. For a long time, foresters have been interested in trying to build scenarios, cutting scenarios, and so forth, and they were interested in modeling tree by tree, because the harvest rate needs to have a realistic output. So the scale are completely different. But through time, and this is what this second part of the slide is trying to show, through time, these two logics are really coming together. I mean, this is probably an opinion which is shared by a number of people, not only mine, but it seems like there is a lot more individual-based thinking in land surface models, and a lot more global approaches, or at least regional approaches, in individual-based models. Just an example, this is a slide coming from LPG Guess, showing that LPG has this individual-based approach, actually, built in the model, and it's an average tree within that represents different size of the cohort. Why is that important? Because the origin of those models are vegetation structures which are really like crops, with a really simple structure. Annuals, biomass storage is very predictable, and so forth. Forests, they grow for a long time, they accumulate carbon, they accumulate they change the property through time. So we need to accommodate for this forest structure in one way or the other to really become realistic in global modeling exercises. And this is a difficult task. So the individual-based model approach is sort of alleviating a lot of the problems, and because they are really already at the scale at which we make the measurements, and second, at which we understand the structure of the forest. So they have a number of advantages in this way. Of course, the real problem is that everyone thinks, how can you model the entire Amazon tree by tree? Does it make any sense? Or is there any interest in doing this, even scientifically? Or is it just consuming computer resources, which actually have a climate cost of energies? We have to be mindful of that. One component that I think is really quite important here is that because we are modeling the forest exactly the same scale at which we are collecting the data, we can start to think about using this type of scale with assimilating the type of information we already have in our databases as ecologists. And because we are in the community of ecologists now, it's quite easy to show you the next slide with plant functional traits that you've been really active in this lab to collect. The type of leaf traits or wood traits, these are really measured at the heart of it. Within a tree, an individual tree, an individual plant. So, the type of information that we would like to incorporate in the models should be at the same scale at which we are collecting the data. This is the point I would like to make. So, instead of constructing the model and try to feed the data, what we've tried to do in my lab for the past many years is to construct a model around the data to try to be parsimonious with models and be as simple as possible, but just as simple as the data suggests us to be. And this is the troll model. So this is where I'm going. This is why I'm highly biased. I will be talking about this model and try to advertise it. This model is individual based. It's it has a very simplistic concept of a tree. It's a lollipop tree with a very simple structure. So all of you working on TLS are raising their eyebrows. It's kind of stupid, but this is the crown. The crown has a does not actually have a mass, but it has a leaf density. Has biometric size and dimensions. It's located within a grid of 1 square meter, so the maximum number of trees you can put in this forest is 10,000 trees per hectare, which is a lot. So the minimal size of trees is 1 centimeter in dBH, in diameter. And we also model the light environment by creating a voxel space from above the tallest tree to the ground. So we are, all the trees are embedded into this voxel, and the voxel size is 1 cubic meter. Every tree is attached to a species label. And so it's individual based in that sense, because it's really fully individual based. We have the location of every tree. It's species specific, and it's spatially explicit you got it. Now, over the past few years, especially with Isabel, we've included the physiology, better representation of the physiology of the trees. So now we have a number of leaves per tree, and these leaves are performing photosynthesis following the classic Farquhar model. We also include a hydraulic model. The stomata control is being controlled, is being taken into account using not so recent, but rather more recent theories by Glenda Nilin and Colin Prentice, which is say that the intercellular CO2 divided by atmospheric CO2 concentrations are given by pretty much are dependent on the vapor pressure deficit, with this parameter being fixed more or less across species. And we also include autotrophic respiration. At leaf level, we don't include stem respiration, but how much we want to add to this. The ecology part is rather expected. If you know, the sorting model is quite similar, actually. So seeds are produced, and producing seeds needs some carbon to be allocated for that. They are dispersed in the neighborhood, and they can germinate if they are in the proper environment. The major force for allowing trees to actually seeds to actually germinate is light availability, obviously. So, and we have this information, of course. Then trees grow according to some allometric relationships. I'll go back to this. We have some, a bit more involved leaf modules, because, of course, this being a photosynthetic model, we have to take into account the efficiency of leaves given their age, so we include that, and a number of causes for mortality. So we have a very simple tree-fall module, which is basically a random one depending on tree height. So Toby could comment on whether we could improve that, but we have some ideas. We have a density dependence effect, which is basically Jensen-Connell effect operated at this scale. So the more trees you have of the same species, the more likely it will be that they die. We have the carbon starvation effect, and we would like to improve this and have a hydraulic effect. And how do we calibrate this model? Well, the one thing we've tried, as I was explaining, is to make the best use of the data. Some of the parameters we don't know that well, species by species. And these are the light extinction rates, apparent quantum yield, the stomata control parameters that we're explaining, the Medlin parameter or Prentice parameter, depending on who you're talking to. Allocation models, these are probably best known in this lab in the world. So you have a lot of data that nobody else has. But if you These are not species-specific data, usually. And we have a basal mortality rate also, which is unaccounted for mortality rate. And some of the parameters we can know species by species, like leaf counts per area, nitrogen, phosphorus content, that help us calibrate the photosynthetic model, wood density, that help us convert tree allocation into volume and seed size and allometric parameters. So that we put into the model, and now I'll let you show you some validation of the data. Again, in French Guiana, so NORAG is here, and this is the Paracou site, which is 120 kilometers away towards the coastal zone. At both sites, we have a lot of tree inventories. We have Eliflux covering systems, and we have LiDAR data. So I'll be showing some validations with this type of data. But before that, so this is Isabel, for you who don't know her. She's here. She's actually in Cambridge at the moment. Oh, I shouldn't be talking about that. These are the parameters that we have, we know globally, and because we don't know them that well, what we try to do is to sort of best fit them. And the way we did this was to compare for 1,000 simulations with a random draw of those parameters with the outcome of the number of trees above 10 centimeters, above 30 centimeters, GDP, above ground biomass, and LRI, leaf area index. So on the horizontal here, you'll see this gray shaded area, which are the expectations are based on the data we know of. So we sort of calibrate the model with just this expectation, only on these parameters. All the species-specific data are not optimized or calibrated, they are just given. And so when we do this, you see there are some dependencies, especially with the high dependence of the extinction rate on the number of features, not a lot of variability on allocation features for these parameters. And so we found a best fit scenario, and then we run the model, again bearing in mind that the vast majority of the parameters are not fine tuned. And so this is what the simulations look like. So we have, in terms of the number of trees per with deviation of more than 10 centimeters, this is an offshoot, and then stabilizes. And the points here are secondary forest plot that we've been following for the past 40 years. So you see that the model is kind of overestimating the number of trees early on. And this is the estimation of the end, which is actually something that we've been using to calibrate, so it's not really surprising to have this kind of good fit. This is the biomass estimated, so again, the data that we use for validation and the shape of the data. Same for the carbon fluxes. This is the GPP as measured in Paracou, which is around 40 megagrams of carbon per hectare per year. And this is what we modeled, so it's not so far away. What's interesting here is also the short-term dynamics. Of course, we have no way to calibrate this because there is no eddyflux system in a secondary forest. I mean, there is one, but there is no communication on this. This is the safe experiment, so looking forward to see whether this, we could use this type of data. And finally, I think the really interesting part of this is try to bond with field botanists by showing them how the species by species, they respond through time to the disturbance, full clear cut. So this is, in green here, for instance, is Cecropia, and then you have intermediate disturbance species like Lalesia or Gutia, and the late successional species are taking over, but much later. So we have this successional dynamics models, and of course it's a really interesting field to compare with what we know and the temporality of changes in a community. Right, just a final word on this model. It's written in C++, and it's the coding principle is keep it simple and short. I know this is not how it goes usually, but I'll try to be polite here. The thing is that it's only a bit over 6,000 lines, including all the comments. So it's not a large code. Usually, students come in my lab with some background in coding. They can master this code within a week or two. So they can understand what's going on with these different elements. And it's a major difference from the large models like Ed and others, in that it's kind of agile. We can really test a lot of hypotheses with this type of short models that can be tweaked any way you want quite quickly. We have published a version last year in Ecological Monographs, and we are working now on the new version, which should be published this year, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, now the last part of my talk will be, you know, trying to bring these two elements together. How do we use the remote sensing data to better know the parameters of the model, if we believe that those parameters are relevant? So this is the concept of this has been published this year in your phytologist. And the idea is to do pretty much the same thing we've been doing back in really calibrate models with the remote sensing data. It's not as easy as it may seem, because we have this highly complex suite of data. We have airborne scans of a forest that we compare to the simulations. So we need to do a lot of things. We need to find good metrics to compare these simulations and data. And then we need to refine the parameters, reformulate potentially the model, or reformulate the parameters, the summary statistics and the metrics of goodness of fit, and to redo this several times. We've been thinking of different ways of doing this. I'll show you a solution. Eventually, in this slide, what we're trying to show is that not only with this approach we are optimizing our model, but we are also producing ways to generate scenarios for dynamic vegetation models. So we are sort of really mimicking, we're creating a dynamic mock-up of a forest that could be then used by DGVMs as inputs or as validations, independent validations. So I think this connection between individual-based models and dynamic vegetation models don't have to be one or the other. They could be individual-based models could be used as emulators of DGVMs. And there are some thinking, especially with the faith people, with the NGE tropics people, along these lines. So it's a bit uncharted ground. Let's put it that way. Okay. So how do we do this? So this is a picture of Fabian, who's been doing a lot of this work. So and part of this, what I'm showing here, is actually not finished yet. So basically, what we hope to constrain with LiDAR data are the structural features of the forest, especially allometric features. So we have a number of simplistic assumptions in the first version of Shoal: the canopy size, depth, total height of the tree are all related to DBH through a series of equations. In the first version of Troll, it was just hardwired with a number of parameters taken from all fields. Of course, you know very well that these parameters are highly plastic from forest to forest, because species are different, environmental conditions are different. And so it's far from being satisfactory. And if you say, well, solution would be to have collect a large number of these numbers for many trees, it's not easy. We have TLS now, and probably will be a great help to construct collections of data for calibrating this type of equations or other equations similar, but it's still relying on hard-won data. So we were thinking of trying to optimize these parameters using the approach that is in this slide, basically by inferring the best parameters of these equations. And that is done by this is just a technical aside. To better represent the structure of the forest, we still have this lollipop concept of a tree, but it's hollow. So because it's partly the crown is partly hollow, we call this we think that the best way of modeling the structure of a tree now is not to have this perfect structure, but we're using the same perfect plasticity approximation as has been used in the past in Ed, for instance, by trying to let the tree occupy or colonize a voxel in space, depending on how far it is from the stem, trying to, you know, venture in the empty areas where there is a lot of light. So it's a bit of a competition for space. So it will this model represents much better the crown shyness concept. So it's really quite interesting. We're still working on how to optimize this, but it doesn't come with any cost in terms of computation size, and it's actually much more efficient than the previous model. So this is just an aside technically, but I think it's very interesting to see how plastic the model can be, how adaptable it can be to new concept of tree shapes, especially crown shapes. So with that, we've been showing that, you know, by optimizing the data of a tree, so this is the simulation and this is the airborne LiDAR data, you see really a fairly good match of the two. But you can do two things. The first thing that we've proposed in this paper was to have a statistical rendition of the forest that would be okay for a number of statistics like canopy height, mean canopy height. This is the mean canopy height of the LiDAR data, and this is the mean canopy height of the simulated data. So they're pretty much indistinguishable. The only difference here is that the big tree is here, and the big tree is here. So they are not exactly in the same location. We can do better, and this is what I'm showing here, is that we are now working on this new version that attributes trees where they should be. So we're putting a big tree where we have a tall information from the LiDAR. So it's an iterative process, it's a bit longer, and we had to construct a separate software to do this. But basically what we're doing today is we have a canopy, what we call the canopy constructor, that uses the LiDAR data and ground data, optimizes this through iteratively, and produces this initial point to then run the troll model. And when you look at these two images, you certainly pick the differences, especially the shape of the cones are not exactly perfect, but then it becomes quite good. And there is no cost in terms of computing power, so it's quite good, because then we have two things from this. The first one is we have a perfect initial point for our simulation, and the second thing is that we have inferred the parameters or the allometries of the trees based on the LiDAR data, so we optimize the allometry features of the tree. So one example of this is probably in the next slide here. The maximal height inferred and the slope of the maximal height is taken from these ensemble of points, and by iterative processes, what we call approximate Bayesian computation, we infer this number of valid points in all the simulations we've run. Basically, we run a million of the simulations, and we pick up the ones that match the best with the summary statistics that we're interested in. This is how it's really an intuitive way to deal with the data. These are the variance in height as the prior and the posterior, showing that when you start with a flat prior, you do have information in the LiDAR data that sort of improve the quality of the parameters. And we can also do this with a crown radius information, and that works also quite well here. So basically here, what I'm trying to express is that without even doing any field work with measuring crown radiuses and so forth, there is already quite a bit of information in airborne LiDAR data. And not perfect, of course. I mean, we don't have a super peaked posterior here, but it's much better than nothing. And with that, just as a glimpse, that's the end of what I want to show you. As a glimpse, just forays into other areas that we'd like to cover. It's 45 minutes, 46 minutes, so I'll take a couple more minutes if I can. tree falls, I mean, this is... couldn't miss that, so it's topical. I had to add a slide on this, and also other types of mortality. I think we all agree that mortality is the most difficult part in most of these models. We don't agree because there is no one sitting next to a tree when it dies. We usually don't have a lot of information of how trees die. And we know there are plenty of reasons for why trees may die, including tree fall because of wind, including diseases, mortality because of starvation or because of hydraulic failure. This is only four out of many others, but these are probably the most important globally. How do we go about in trying to be more mechanistic about this? It's very difficult. It takes full PhDs to do that, even for brilliant students. So we would like to do this. We started this project with Yiping, a PhD student here, not even knowing that you were doing this. So it's a bit of a shame, but it's some sort of it's quite nice actually. The idea is that Yiping came in my lab. He's coming from Taiwan, and was really interested in knowing how typhoon were shaping up the forest of Fushan, which is one of the forest geo sites. So he wanted to develop a version of troll with including tree falls and trying to see how the forest is shaped, not only looking at the mortality of tree by tree, but looking at the entire community level response of the forest, because when you go to Fushan, you see that the canopy is much more homogeneous than it is in all the forests we know of. So there must be some sort of, not to use improperly evolutionary terms, but it is some sort of selection at ecosystem level for some types of shapes. So we've been starting with the Gardiner forest scale model. I've learned yesterday that it is not great, especially the breakage part. So there are two parts here. The breakage is okay, sorry. The overtopping is basically ad hoc and it's based on empirical data, so we should probably not use that. But this part here has been greatly advanced by Toby and others, so I think there is ways to go further here. What we're interested in is not take away the concept of the tree we have, so we'd like to find very simple statistics of crown shape, size, or whatever that we can plug into the model. With not too much cost in terms of computational effort, because this is key at the end of the day. And hopefully, we can work together to try and improve that. The second point is try to incorporate the water module in troll. It's been done by many. I'm citing the old paper by Matt Williams, who's been the first to actually do that. We'd like to do this at individual scale. That was actually Isabel's PhD project. She did a really great PhD, and she didn't do that. Perhaps because it's a bit more complicated than we thought, but she still has this on the top of her agenda, I hope. Remind her. Okay, and the final point here is that what's been difficult here with this problem is to find parameters to constrain all these parameters, all these resistances. And what we found during the PhD, Isabel's PhD, working with Lauren Sack, is that we could measure the potential loss point potential there. What the Americans know called the TLP, which is actually potential at toggle loss point. And we can measure it easily by using a method that's been developed by Lawrence Lab. So we've been doing this at NURAG again, my last advertisement for NURAG of the talk. And what we found was quite interesting that we have across a fairly large data set, this method is much faster than any other previous method of measuring potential at toggle loss point. That the forests, on average, the tree species were much more tolerant to drought at leaf level, and there was a really wide spread of values. Some species have leaves that are hugely drought tolerant, and others not so much. But so it's the facility at which we can accumulate this type of data opens new avenues for calibrating this hydraulic module with just this parameter, but that would be species specific. With that, of course, we'd like to port the airborne LADAR data at the scale of GDI. I think it would be super interesting. It's not so easy to do this because we don't have this proper scale and the proper rendition, but this is something we'll definitely try to do as soon as we get the data, which would be probably this fall. And summary, Troll was tailored to optimally use plant trade databases and ecological inventory data. So marginally, forest NGO-based models are useful ecological data assimilators And so I see really those models are a way to first to teach a lot of concepts that are not so easy to teach, like carbon allocation, photosynthesis. When you see that at work in a model, it's much easier. Then Troll jointly simulates tree inventory, Ediflux, and remote sensing information as it's shown, and as perspectives, you see that windthrow module and water module will be opportunities. I say that before, but I will reiterate, there are lots of shared interests between our lives, and I'd be really more than happy to have more active collaboration. Thank you very much.